Grab your favorite caffeinated beverage and get cozy because you are listening to Mindful as a Mother with Paige Bruce and Lindsay Adams.
Do you remember those toys from when we were kids where you would fit the different shaped pegs into the different shaped holes?
Yeah.
That's a lot like parenting, except when you have a neurodivergent child, using traditional parenting techniques is like trying to put the round peg in the star hole.
That's exactly how I felt when I discovered that Sam was neurodivergent. I knew that traditional parenting techniques and even the approaches that I was taught in grad school, they didn't feel right in my soul to like supporting who he was as a human. And they also just weren't effective. And that's when I discovered the power of responsive parenting.
Exactly. So if you are like us and are interested in tailoring responsive parenting techniques to your neurodivergent world, check out our Parenting Your NeuroSpicy video series. You can find it in our Stand store at the link in the show notes.
It is so hard to find social and emotional learning toys that will actually be engaging and fun for your child. And that's why we are so excited that we are partnering with Slumberkins.
In our home, we're really struggling right now with the idea that I'm the worst kid ever. I'm a horrible sister anytime we make a mistake. And so we recently brought in the Yak, which is all about self-acceptance for kids. And it's made such a difference. When we're struggling, we can remember that our brain is lying to us and say Yak's affirmation, I am loved as I am. When things get tough, I go back to my heart. I know I am enough.
Oh, I love this. It's hard for me to find toys that are in or stuffies that are engaging for my kids. And normally I take them to my office, but with the Slumberkins, I haven't even been able to get them to my office because my kids are so obsessed. So if you want to try Slumberkins, you can go to their website. We'll also put it in the show notes and use the code MindfulAsAMother for 15% off at checkout.
This podcast is not intended to be a substitute for therapy or the therapeutic relationship, and the information given in this podcast is purely for educational purposes and is not intended to replace the advice of a professional.
Hello and welcome back to Mindful as a Mother. My name is Lindsay Adams and I'm here with Paige Bruce. Say hi.
Hey guys.
We are on podcast weekend. It is spooky season, and I lit a rug in the Airbnb on fire last night.
Okay, so last night was a full moon, and we were writing stuff down. We wanted to burn it. Poor decisions were made from everybody involved.
Yes. And I had a freeze response, which that's why I'm telling this story, which I haven't had in a really long time, where I literally, like, dropped a burning paper on a rug and I could not move. My body froze.
Yeah. We just watched it.
We just watched it. And then I tried to use another piece of paper on fire to put out the fire. I fought fire with fire, guys. So I will be confronting all of life's biggest challenges, meaning having a conversation with the Airbnb owner, apologizing, purchasing a new rug, all the things. And the funny thing is, in the full moon ceremony, I asked to release fear around confrontation and hard conversations. And
yeah,
then
literally all the housework we were just talking about in the last few episodes.
Yeah. So we have come full circle, friends. And yeah. But today we're talking about parenting ADHD kids or neurospicy kids. And the title of the chapter from Your Brain Is Not Broken by Dr. Tamara Rosier is The Island of Misfit Toys. And I think of this like the daycare in Toy Story 3, like the toys from the daycare. Like, they're a little different. They're still fun, but they just operate differently. And we play with them differently.
Yeah. So for those that haven't seen Toy Story 3, you have like the older kids' classroom, maybe like the 5 to 7 year olds. And then you have like the toddler classroom, which is infant to 4 year olds. And the good toys are in the 5 to 7 year olds because they're cared for. And then anything that gets really mangled and messed up isn't working necessarily the way it's supposed to, or we've cut Barbie's hair or there's a leg missing, goes in the infant room. And that is the Island of Misfit Toys.
Yeah.
And it can feel like when you are a child who is neurodivergent, you are in the island of misfit toys. Like, you're just different. You don't work the same way the other toys work.
Yeah. And you don't understand why, because you look the same, but yeah, the process is different.
Yes. So we're going to talk about tips for parenting your toy.
Your children are toys.
Your children are toys. All right. What's the first?
So the first thing I think would be important to identify is that often neurodivergent children develop a lower sense of self-esteem and confidence.
Right. And because they're constantly receiving criticism, correction, negative feedback about their behavior, their process, stay on task, blah, 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 that naturally they have lower self-esteem.
There was a study done where on average a neurodivergent child received 40 commands in a 30-minute window, and a neurotypical peer received 18 in the same 30-minute window.
Well, and the example that's coming to mind too is, like, I look at, like, my son has autism and ADHD, and so the constant, like, commands are demands as well, right? So there's, like, the PDA piece, the pathological demand avoidance. So then you add in that, and it's like, so they're receiving this many commands in a 30-minute period, and every command is perceived by the body as a demand.
Yeah.
No wonder they're overwhelmed with demands.
Yeah. I think about it like my kids say, mom, 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 and there's not enough space in between it for me to respond, to acknowledge that they're even calling my name, right?
Yeah.
That's kind of how I view redirecting a neurodivergent child.
Exactly. It's like, do you watch Family Guy?
Yeah.
Yeah. Mommy, mom, mom. There's a meme.
Mama,
mama, mama. Yeah. 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 That's what it's like for them. And recognizing that when kids are in their formative years, especially, that everything is about them and they take personally, right? Naturally. And then you add in the neurospicy effect, and that is, like, amplified. And so they're taking in all of this feedback, like, I can't do anything right. And I'm the problem. It's me.
This age, they internalize everything as a characteristic rather than an experience. So if we're giving, it's like a balancing scale, like a weight scale, you know, like those justice system weight scales. Mm-hmm. If we're constantly giving them the unspoken message that they are wrong, then they will develop a sense that they are bad. And in the book, actually, Tamara Rosier talks about how she remembers being her daughter's age and thinking and wondering, why don't I get it? Mm-hmm. Like, why don't I understand the same, or how come I can't think of the same thing? Mm-hmm. And it made me think of Yuri this week, actually. She had the stomach bug on Thursday. Thank God I'm not puking. She had a stomach bug on Thursday, and her older sister wanted to stay home and take care of her, so they stayed home together all day. And at one point, she was playing with, like, a stuffed animal and threw it in the backyard, you know, like you would throw a baby and, like, catch them.
Yeah.
She accidentally threw it on top of the roof.
Uh-huh.
And Alayla had a big emotional response to it, because that was, like, her favorite very special muffin is what she named it. And Yuri ran away crying. And so I was working with Alayla through problem solving. Like, we talked about her response and what a big feeling it was, and, like, different ways we could work through getting Muffin off of the roof, and trial and error. And I let her try all the things before, like, I was truly the tallest person in the house that could, like, use the broom and get Muffin down. But then after all that calmed down, Alayla felt much better, but Yuri still didn't. So she came to me, and Alayla was trying to play with her, but she still wasn't open. And so I asked her, I was like, can you tell me what's happening for you? And she said, I feel like every time I try something, I'm a bad girl.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah.
So I was like, this is a very real example of how a mistake was made, but it became a piece of identity.
Uh-huh.
It wasn't, I accidentally threw Muffin on the roof, and then we have to figure out how to get Muffin down. It was, I'm a bad sister. Because every time I try to play, something happens.
Is this the same response I had last night with the candle?
Where you internalized it?
Yeah.
You didn't tell me that you felt like a horrible human.
Well, yeah, I probably didn't open up about it, but I did. I was like, who is, I think it's like a dumb thing. Like, what were you thinking type? And that's probably like a childhood response for me.
Probably to internalize.
When really it's just it's a rug. Like,
right. It's not war. That's what I told you last night. I was like, it's not life or death.
Yeah. But for me, it was like, I'm a terrible person because I had this accident, which is probably my own stuff internalized from that age.
Well, and you took full blame when I quite literally was also right next to you. Lindsay suggested that we don't burn it over the rug. And I said, no. Like,
yeah.
But she's like, God, I knew I should have done this or that. And I'm so, it's like, I also was an active participant in what was probably not great, like no foresight of consequence.
Yeah. Well, and I think these are really great examples, both with Yuri and with the rug, because it shows us how these things show up in our daily lives and in our thought patterns, where I didn't even express that to you on the outside because I'm so good at masking and I don't want to, like, that's not a badge of honor. But like,
excuse me.
It happens in our thoughts. We make a mistake, and what does our brain immediately go to? And you may not even realize that it goes to, I'm the worst kid ever, you know, which is where the, you know, we do a lot of content surrounding this. Does your child go from zero to I'm the worst kid ever?
Yeah.
And that's what happens because of the level of emotional intensity and the way that they perceive these redirections.
Yeah. And again, these eight, at this age, she's six, almost seven. So I would say six on, it is developmentally appropriate for them to have this response of like internalizing stuff, and then you just add in the spiciness of the intensity of the emotion, how that factors into development. So while we're on the topic, like we've gotten some questions lately because we talk about how when your child does this, like I didn't go to Lindsay and I didn't say, you're not the worst person ever, it's fine, right? Like I didn't, that wasn't my response to you. I talked about how it was probably embarrassing, right? And that there was a lot of fear around it. Was that uncomfortable for you, or did it feel validating?
No, it felt validating.
Okay. So when our children respond in this way, our go-to is to be like, no, you're not the worst. Like my kids have definitely told me, I'm the worst kid ever. I'm a horrible sister. I shouldn't be allowed to do da-da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
Right? And so our go-to as parents is we don't want our children to suffer, so we want to solve the problem. So we just tell them, like, you're not the worst kid ever. Think of all these wonderful things you do. You're such a great sister. Like, all this stuff.
And what you have to realize is that that need to fix it is about you. Yeah. That is about your uncomfortability with them experiencing a very real and intense emotion. And I'm not saying that your feelings aren't valid, because they absolutely are.
Yeah.
But what you're doing in that moment is you're trying to make your child feel better so you can feel better.
Yes. And it's because it comes out of love.
Yeah.
If you didn't have an intense love for your child, you wouldn't care if they were hurting or internalizing this.
Mm-hmm.
So it doesn't mean you're a bad parent. It means that you love your kid.
It means you're a good parent. Yeah.
Yeah. And so what, give examples or like talk about the skill of what we're actually trying to teach parents to do in these situations.
So you want to let them know that they're not alone. So I'll use the example last night of some things Paige did that were good. So like, we joked about it, but then she asked me, she was like, am I hurting your feelings? And I was like, no, it feels good to laugh. Because also when I'm super embarrassed, I'm like a giggler. It's like a nervous system response. So as we're like lighting the rug on fire, and then it continued, the candle actually exploded. It was a whole thing. Like it just kept, and we just kept laughing more and more, like what is happening here? And it actually helped me, I think, move that energy in my body that we just laughed about it forever. And then we were making up stories about how I could like explain this to the Airbnb owners and kind of just joking a lot. And so that was really helpful, but it was also from a space of like, I understand how uncomfortable this is for you and that this is a challenge for you to one, have had this happen, but then also to have to confront it. So I felt very understood. And then this morning even Paige shared with me a few things about her life where she's had to confront hard conversations with people for
and I won't share what it is unless you're comfortable, but like hard conversations about things that have happened in her life, and how the first time it was like really scary and she actually made her husband do it and she was like peeking out the blinds watching him have it. But then as it's gotten easier, it's gotten better. So then I felt so alone because I was like, oh, I'm not the only one that struggles with this or that has to have these conversations. So you can use that as a model for how to support your kids. And obviously the language around it and how you do it will look different in a parent-child relationship. But it involves just saying like, I know this is hard. I know this feels intense right now. I know that, you know, you're having big feelings about this. We don't have to. And a lot of people, their response when I say like hold space for their emotion is, well, I don't want to confirm that they, that thing about themselves. I'm the worst kid ever. And it's like, you don't say, yeah, you're the worst kid ever. You say, I can see how hard this is for you.
Yeah, exactly. And I even provided some examples that I use in my house. Like I hate myself or I hate you. And so I sit for a second as a parent, and I know I have a lot to unpack in my own child with that specific phrase, but hate is not a feeling. Hate is not a feeling word, honestly. And even saying that out loud, I was like, wait, is that true? It's true. Hate is not a feeling word.
Yeah.
And so I said, I would tell my kids like, hate is a really strong word. What feeling is underneath that? And they are like, I don't know. And I was like, sounds like maybe you feel angry or you feel sad. Like I try to help them find the feeling to express what they're feeling, like the word to express the feeling without the labeling of like an entire characteristic.
Right. And it not being like about them. The thing that's really helpful with this, especially with like neurospicy kids, but all kids, is a visual of like what feelings are what, so that they can point or reference or look at it, just to like add that in.
Yeah. And I know this is something we unpack a lot as therapists that work with children. As parents and good parents, we don't want our children to suffer. We don't want them to feel pain or to have this level of dysregulation. However, this is good for your child. Your children need to experience this. And if we continually rescue them because they're hurting, they won't develop the level of resiliency they will need to continue to live a successful, healthy adult life.
Right. And especially if your child is deeply feeling. So if your child has these reactions to criticism now consistently, or feedback, they are mistakes or accidents, they are going to have it through their adult life. Look at me, right? Like there's more than one reason this candle fell over. So now I guess I have something to talk about on the podcast, but put the candle fell over. I lit the place on fire. Okay. So they're like, it's going to be a skill that that will come up for them. So just because you can talk them out of hating themselves in that, or thinking that they hate themselves in that one instance, it does not mean that they're developing the actual skills to manage the intense emotions. And if you switch from instead of convincing them that they are not the worst child ever, to I'm going to teach them the skills to manage these intense emotions, because they're likely going to continue to come up throughout their life. And I had a solid base of skills last night. So like, I felt like I could regulate through that intense emotion. And at one point, after I had like gotten my giggles out, started to regulate, like I had the thought, like, this is my process when I make bigger mistakes like this. Like I have this thing where I know that it will pass, and this is how I feel about myself. And there was like extreme comfort in that, because I've lived through this cycle and I know that it's not forever.
Yeah, that it ends. You know that it ends. You rehearse that it ends.
And I knew, like, at one point we were trying to clean up wax and we were both just like, we need to go to bed. It was midnight by this point. And I knew that if I didn't just go to bed, I would wake up and I would feel totally different about it in the morning. And I did. Because that has been my experience in the past, because I've ridden this wave for 34 years. And so trying to show your child and show your child's body that through supporting them through the emotion is the goal here.
Yes. Also, something that is extremely impactful once you start to build the awareness around it is your stories as a human being for your children. Like, I mess up all the time, and I think as a parent, sometimes we know that and we assume our kids know that, but our kids think we're perfect. They think we make no mistakes. And so one night I had a PTA meeting at my house which is a whole other ballgame. Like during the bedtime routine, it was a very long one where we were discussing bylaws and like legal verbiage for things. So it was like intense and my kids were just like doing their thing. And Alayla had taken, she's 8, almost 9, so she took an egg out of the fridge, a raw one, and took it to her bedroom, like without asking, without any knowledge, and then accidentally crushed it in her bed and in her bedding. And then was like trying to clean it up in secret because she was scared of getting in trouble.
Yeah.
So she came and she told me, and I think my response, it wasn't a reaction, it was a response, surprised her because I stepped out of like the little meeting, like I just turned in the chair, but my body was totally facing her. And I was like, when I was your age, I really wanted to hatch an egg in my bed. And so I took one out of the fridge and I sat it under my pillow and I sat on top of it and I crushed it in my bed. And she was like, what? And I was like, yeah. And it was all over my sheets. Uh-huh. And she was like, oh, that's kind of what just happened with me. I didn't sit on it, but like I was crushed it. And I was like, that's okay. I was like, go ahead and put your sheets in the washing machine like you know how to do.
Yeah.
And we'll wash them.
Yeah.
And she was like, okay. And then I said, the reason you won't get a chick out of it, because she was like, can I have another one and try again?
Yeah, she's like very into the chick situation.
So the reason you won't get a chick out of it is because these eggs aren't fertilized. And maybe in the spring when there are eggs, we can talk about incubating an egg to see the process of it fertilized. But eggs from our fridge will never hatch baby chicks. Mm-hmm. And so she, it was like, oh, okay. And then she put her stuff in the washing machine. It was no big deal. There weren't like, there wasn't any shame developed around it. And she, like her comfort, I could see her whole body and demeanor shift that I, when I was her age, I had a similar curiosity and a similar thing happened to me. But I'll tell you, at my age, that was not something I told my parents.
Yeah.
Because there would have been extreme consequences.
Yeah.
So it was something that I hid for a very long time.
Yeah. Well, and I think just she, in that moment, she felt, mom gets me.
Yeah.
And that's
what that's the validation.
And that's what you want to communicate however you do that. So if you don't have a story that pertains or a time you felt similar. So for, and if you have a neurospicy child and you have these same feelings, like I use the example of when people are upset at me, because this is my Ava, it feels very like if her sister is mad at her, she feels like she needs to fix it immediately and she's a bad sister and mm-hmm. and all the things. So I say this same thing to her. When people are upset at me, I feel the same way. And I get how hard it is when someone's upset at you. And we still need to give them space.
Yes.
Because Ella needs to take time to calm down. So it's like, and so I sit with her through that and I'm there with her while Ella is taking her space so that she's not alone in that emotion.
Yeah. And I think as our kids age, you'll have a lot of opportunities for this. And again, you guys are grown-ass adults. So you have a treasure trove of these stories and examples if you are able to reflect on them. And even if it's what you're doing this day, you can talk through that. And these are going to be parenting gold through the teenage years. I swear to God.
It really is, especially because you want an environment where your teenagers are going to come to you and talk about the dumb stuff that they do. And I say dumb with the most love in the entire world, but teenagers can be really dumb. And we want that the environment where they come talk to us about it and they feel safe to do that. And it's hard enough as a teenager, but then you add in the neurodivergent element. And if they have a history of not, of shaming themselves and not learning to sit with that emotion, it's even harder.
Yes.
In the teenage years.
And something that I think we bypass is we think co-regulation is a thing that we do when our children are young. But especially when you have neurospicy kids, you're co-regulating the entire time they're living within your home. I co-regulate with adults. Like Zane helps me co-regulate.
Yeah.
Like control my nervous system, understand my responses, be calm when I typically wouldn't be calm. This is, you are establishing a foundation to be able to support your teen in co-regulating and building like their response bank.
Mm-hmm. And I think that this is where gentle honesty comes in. So like creating an environment where we give feedback and not criticism
and where we support them through the emotional response of that. So creating an environment or culture of gentle honesty is, I think, the first step is creating a structure for how you give feedback and criticism or correction in your home. And to me, this starts with, like, if we can build a culture of this in general, and I think it's good for all humans, but especially neurodiverse families. And I like to think of it as like using connect before you redirect, or like a sandwich in delivering feedback. So sharing something you appreciate, something they're doing well, also getting on their eye level, giving them your full attention, being warm and loving with your tone.
And this is age appropriate at all ages, even though it may sound weird for us to be like, get on your teenager's level and look them in the eye.
Yes.
Like, it's still true.
Yes. And I find too, like, in the chaos of parenting, like, my default is to yell across the house.
Yeah.
And that is not gentle honesty. But then offering correction where it's like, hey, I really appreciate that you're working so hard on your homework, and remember to put a period at the end of your sentences.
Yeah. And this is when we talk about riding the emotional wave. Gentle honesty feedback is not something you give when emotions are heightened. If your child's emotions are heightened, chances are your emotions are heightened. This co-regulation goes both ways. So oftentimes it's like something happens and we're like, I told you not to do that. Why would you, you know, like going off? That is the opposite of what we're talking about. And it takes, like, I used to be reactive in that way where that was my response. I was like, I told you. And sometimes still I have to bite my tongue, right? Because I literally told you that your fingers were going to be shut in the window of this car. Real story. It's like, however, once, okay, I'm just going to tell you. So my kids like to come home from childcare and not be in their car seats, because we live like, it's like a block up the hill.
Uh-huh.
So I drive like 15 miles an hour, and then they like to put their hands out the window.
Uh-huh.
And like pretend they're puppy dogs, like, uh-huh, while we drive around the corner. And we developed this system where I say fingers, and then because we've already had some fingers shut in the, uh-huh, windows, I'm like, we're home, get out of the car. Uh-huh. Smash their fingers. So we have this system where I'm like, fingers, and then they take their fingers out of the car, out of the window. Uh-huh. I roll up the windows, we get out of the car.
Uh-huh.
Well, our response times were really slow one day, and they were playing this game where they would put their fingertips at like the tippy top of the window as it's going up.
Uh-huh.
Almost like
chicken.
Yeah, like chicken, like they're following it. Yeah. And I said, before anything happened, I was like, stop, or your fingers are going to get shut in the window, right? I said that. So it's going. We're playing chicken with the window, and I'm like, fingers, and crunch. Fingers get shut in the window. And then they're like, fingers! And so I like rolled the window down, and it wasn't like, we didn't kill any fingernails or anything. But I rolled the window down, they take their hand out, everyone's sobbing. And I wanted to say,
I told you so.
Like, stop putting your fingers in the window. How many times do I have to say that? But I did not that time. In the previous times, I definitely have. One time I even hit my kid with a car door because she walked next to it while I was getting out. And it was like, boink. Anyways. So what we did is I provided gentle honesty. So it takes time. We rode the emotional wave. The feelings were passed. They're still talking about it because that's still a level of processing. Like, oh, my fingers got shut in the window. And so I say, I remember yesterday when we were doing the same thing, and I made the suggestion that if we continue to do this, our fingers might get shut in the window. And they're like, yeah, you said that. It's like, yeah, and it sucks that our fingers were shut in the window today. Like, yeah. It's like, so what do you think we could do to keep from having our fingers shut in the window next time? Like, till they don't get shut in the window.
I love that. And then sometimes I also take it with older kids, like a step further and say, when I'm communicating things to you, because we don't have a lot of like hard and fast rules in our house. It's mostly surrounding safety.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I'm like communicating that you need to stop doing something. It is typically for a safety reason. And this was a way to learn that when mom says, don't put your fingers up by the window, that I'm not doing that to be mean or to not be fun or to criticize you. It is because I don't want you to get hurt. And so then I think that builds the bank for the future. So when you're offering in the moment, like, don't put your fingers up there, they're realizing that, like, oh, mom's corrections or mom's directness mm-hmm. is about safety rather than about me as a person or yes. like me doing something wrong. Because it's not that you're doing anything wrong. It's I just don't want you to get hurt.
Yeah, right. And so let's even take that into the as a therapist or a counselor, we luckily we're in these positions with teens often where we can provide gentle honesty. That's part of our role, right?
Yeah.
So often it's times like when they chose to go out with their friends instead of completing the homework assignment that they needed to complete. And now they're experiencing the consequence of that.
Yeah.
Right? And so providing that honesty of, you know, you needed to get that assignment in and you chose to go out instead, or you chose to spend time with your friends or not do your assignment, blah, 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 right? It's like, and because of that, now you have a zero and there are consequences. So as a parent, I'm saying now you have a zero. And so the consequence is you won't be able to go out with your friends until you get that assignment in. And yeah. it's reflected in the grade book. Because we all know that there's a discrepancy between things turned in and actual grades listed in the grade yeah. book. However,
yes.
But like that's that part of gentle honesty, like providing that feedback. It's not criticism. I'm not criticizing you for not doing the assignment. I'm acknowledging that there are real consequences for the choice that you made and it sucks, but there are like this and, is what our reality
and
this is.
What it is. And I love that there's not like the emotion, like I told you that if you went out or I told you you needed to have that assignment done or you knew the expectation or whatever it is. It's just like this kind of is what it is and it's not attached to like. And some of that is like regulating your own emotional response before you have a conversation, mm-hmm. but it's not attached to who you are as a human.
Yeah.
And I think for gentle honesty to work, there has to be the foundation of a safe and secure relationship.
Yeah.
And sometimes you almost need to go backwards because there's misattunement and it's not intentional, but I think sometimes we think we're communicating safety to our kids, but we're inadvertently not.
Yeah.
I don't think anyone does it intentionally.
I think the parents that listen to our podcast would not do it intentionally.
Yeah. And I think there's even times where I recognize in myself a pattern that I've had in how I show up for my kids that may communicate something that I'm not meaning to communicate.
Absolutely.
Even as a therapist that's done this forever.
Yeah, absolutely. Because parenting's not perfect and you're yeah. only attuned like 30 to 40% of the time anyways. Yeah.
So if you're struggling even with gentle honesty or your child's having big reactions to that, it may be really great to try and add in some ways to communicate safety and trust and connection in the relationship.
Yeah.
How does a parent do that, Paige?
Well, I really want to touch on this piece that when you are providing gentle honesty, you are, I don't want to say unintentionally, but the undercurrent that you're communicating is the belief of capability also.
Yeah, because your nervous system and your energy behind the conversation is communicating that I believe that you are capable.
Yes. Mm-hmm. So there are so many times when our children are growing, right, that when we are trying to solve the problem rather than validate the experience, what we end up communicating is like when we save our kids, we're communicating that it is inferior. They don't have the ability or the capability of solving this on their own. And they unintentionally enabled and develop lower confidence because of that. So that's something that I really like about this concept of gentle honesty.
Also, another side of the same coin is that with intense emotions, like these big feeling reactions, when we respond to the I hate myself, I'm the worst kid ever with our own big feeling reaction, we're inadvertently communicating to our child that I cannot handle your big feelings mm-hmm. because they create a very intense reaction in me. And that's the exact opposite of what we want to be communicating, which is like, hey, I can handle the big feelings, which means you can handle them too.
Yes. So I think that that's one of the foundational steps in creating that feeling of trust and safety in the relationship. And if you are actively still working on becoming more responsive than, rather than reactive, know that you are not fucking up your child, right? You're not like traumatizing them or ruining them or any of those things that we tell ourselves we are. But as we consistently learn to be able to regulate our own system, to respond instead of react with those big emotions, we are creating a sense of safety and security so we can hold space for what they are experiencing.
Right. And this is going to be imperfect. Like, just know that you're not going to be able to provide gentle honesty 24/7.
Yeah.
It's going to be imperfect. So don't try to be perfect with it. Just try to notice areas where you can make small improvements.
Yes. Okay. And then also this very important piece of knowing that when you are creating this relationship with your kids, you will never be attuned 100% of the time. So there are going to be times when your child or your teens feel disconnected from you and you're not doing anything wrong. Like that is a natural, normal part of having a human relationship, is that sometimes you will be disconnected. Because I think about that, it's myself as a parent, and I never want my teen or my children to think that I don't understand them or feel like I don't know who they are or that we're disconnected. And that brings up a lot of feelings inside of me, but also that's part of the normal human nature of a relationship. So you won't always feel connected. So it's knowing that you have the opportunity to consistently do things to reconnect. So when they're younger, let's talk about some connection and attunement techniques for when they're younger up through teens.
Wait, I want to add one thing first. Okay. I think something that was touched on in our podcast with the author.
Jessica?
Sinarsky. Yes. Was that part of this, like the misattunement, the beauty in the repair is that we're teaching our kids that the secure relationship is across all like distance and time spans.
Yes. Attachment is across distance or space and time.
Meaning that like your child is recognizing and learning, their nervous system is learning that just because you're disconnected or misattuned in this moment, mom always comes back.
Yeah. Like there's always an opportunity for that to be there.
So that there, even though maybe I feel like she missed my signals for connection or was too busy or life got in the way or was dealing with my siblings, I get a lot of questions about like, am I messing up the attachment with my child? And you're actually not, you're helping it because by circling back later and either repairing or having a moment of connection, then you're teaching your child's system that you come back and reconnect so that there is not anxiety in the separation.
Yeah. Exactly. Like if somebody gets mad, right? Like there's so many parents who feel like they can't experience emotions around their children. There are 100% times that I'm angry with my kids, like every other parent. Mm-hmm. And I don't hide that from them. I don't beat them or shame them, right? Like I'm not verbally lashing out all the time. So I make mistakes, but I am expressing like, I feel angry right now. I need some time and space.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel mad. Like, I'm angry that you chose to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But I do come back. And even though it sucks, I think some of the safest relationships I have in my life are with my children.
Mm-hmm.
Because it sucks when somebody feels angry at you or you feel angry with someone else. But then again, that being able to come back and know that, like, my love for you is permanent. Nothing you do is going to change that I love you.
Well, and that is like communicating and creating so many different beautiful dynamics with your kids. So we're talking about you're communicating to them through that. And this is why all of parenting is modeling, right?
Yep.
And it's not just the things you say to them, but you're communicating that like, I can be mad at you and we can still be in relationship. Or I can be upset. I'm not even mad at you, but just mad at the situation. I can be upset that this happened or frustrated that this happened and we need to have a talk later, but I still love and care about you.
Yeah. And we can have a talk and there can be a resolution.
Or I can be upset and I'm not going to abandon you.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to withdraw love. And I think that's the most powerful part in creating those moments of safety and connection in that relationship.
Well, and I look at back to our candle thing. I didn't have that with my own mother.
Mm-hmm.
And so there was always the like, you if you're mad at me, there's a disconnect or a withdrawal from love. So there's this deep fear of conflict and people being upset at me, because in my inner child, my kid brain perceives that as you will be abandoned.
Yeah.
Right? Same. So if someone's upset at me over anything, even Tim sometimes, I have a very intense visceral emotional reaction to it, whereas like, it's not that serious, really.
And yeah, but it feels.
It feels. My body perceives it as being that serious. So in these creating these building blocks for your children, they're likely not going to have the same response in adulthood that I have or that other people have.
Yeah,
and that's our hope. So we're going to, should we talk about some attunement from throughout childhood? Some like attunement skills?
Yeah.
Okay. Go ahead and give some examples about building relationships with your children.
What age?
Let's start with like toddlers and go up through teens.
Okay, so toddlers' attunement is about recognizing their needs and communication and giving them a sense of autonomy, but also being there for comfort and co-regulation.
Yes. So we are meeting needs. We're hungry. Here's food. You're tired. I'm going to help you get to sleep. Like establishing regular routines and structures that work well. Supporting them in like limiting after school activities if you find that they're overstimulated because they can't make that decision on their own. Mm-hmm. Like this is toddlerhood. We're consistently showing up to meet those needs.
Mm-hmm. What about older kids?
So let's say like first through third grade.
Mm-hmm.
First through third grade, I would say is more quality time. So you're still a very important person for your kiddo at this age where they're starting to develop peer relationships, but they still lean really heavily on parents.
Mm-hmm.
So, finding activities that you guys like to do together. I like to intentionally do like a family night once a week, mm-hmm. right? Where we do like pizza and a movie or, sharing stories from my own life while we intentionally do spend activities together, like finding ways to relate and getting to know their interests and supporting their interests.
Yeah, supporting interests is a big
and
one.
And big emotionality here. Yeah. Lots and lots of like the validation and empathizing starts. I think empathizing and validating always, but it looks different in this age group because there's going to be more of like, I want to problem solve. Yeah. And that's going to be less of a reality. When there's toddlers and there's big emotions, you're teaching a lot of problem solving and you are doing a lot of problem solving. Like there's a conflict and we both want these blocks, right? We're working through that. When they're like 7 to 9 or 10, you are now working through, you're going to be much more hands off. You're going to be much more validating and you're going to encourage self-efficacy, which would be like the capabilities of their child solving their own problems.
Yes. And
while you hold their hand.
Yeah. And I think this is also the prime age for like connecting via statements and like saying, oh, I thought of you today. How did your math test go?
Yeah. Or even without asking, I thought of you during your math test.
Yeah. So that we're not like putting them on the spot and doing the like, how was your day thing?
Yeah. One of my favorite things to do is when I see my kids again, they're in these ages now. My youngest will be 5 on Wednesday.
That's crazy.
October 4th. Okay. So 5 to 9 is to reconnect. Sometimes that's a big hug. Sometimes they don't want to hug me. But I tell them, I was like, I missed you today. Mm-hmm. I thought about you today.
Mm-hmm. Or sometimes I'll bring home, like if I see stickers or like a small treat, I'll be like, I was at the gas station today and I thought of you. So I grabbed you a sucker because I know you really like this. Like these like little thoughtful ways to connect, I think are really good at this age.
Yeah.
And being, you know, invested in like, oh, especially say that your child likes like screens or a certain, like Sam's super into Marvel right now. So it's like, hey, there's a new Spider-Man movie I saw.
Yeah.
Do you want to watch that with me tonight? Yeah. Or those kind of connections.
My kids are at the age where they like to watch the Halloween Baking Championship with me now.
Oh, yeah.
So we started watching them because they just were released and there's one every week. So we sit down at night and it's like a night they go to bed a little bit later. But we're like watching Halloween Baking Championship and then talking about who we think's gonna win or whose dessert we like the most.
Oh, we watch Bake Squad. What's Halloween Baking Championship on?
Discovery Plus.
Okay, I'll have to watch that with them because we've been doing Bake Squad because I've been trying to find these things these shows to connect where it's like we can do a family connection, but it's not necessarily just like cartoons and Disney movies. Not that that's not fun, but I think like having these competitions are things you can talk about. So I've been doing a lot of Bake Squad. They also love The Home Edit.
Oh, I haven't tried that one.
So, and so then they got like really motivated. They wanted to like organize their room. So this is an attunement thing I did. One night I had the kids, they went with Tim and they were watching a show and I did. So my girls share room and Sam shares room. And I went in and I just kind of like picked up and organized their room, in a way that, so first they went in with me, like they do in The Home Edit. We did it like a Home Edit redo. And they told me like what they wanted to edit out, what they wanted to get rid of. They helped me go through the stuff. And then I had them leave with Tim and I like organized the room in a way that I felt was like functional for them. And then I did like a big reveal. And they were so excited. So I did Sam's room first, and then the girls were so excited I could barely keep them out of their room while I did it. And I just like moved furniture. I didn't purchase anything too. That was the challenge I gave myself. Like, I'm not gonna buy anything. I'm just gonna use stuff we have to make it functional. And they thought it was the coolest thing ever. And then they went and told their entire school that like I organized their room and I surprised them. And so like, oh, for me, that was a good way of like being attuned and connecting, because they were interested in that. They were wanting to organize their room, and they didn't necessarily, all my kids are at the level where they don't have the skills to organize on their own yet, but the skill now is maintaining an organized system. So I thought if I could just set it, then we could work on the real life skill of maintaining. And I made it this big fun thing. So now there's buy-in in it. So like, it's not just pick up your room. It's like when I'm telling them like, okay, we need to pick up our room, and we're practicing like, okay, where does this go? It's all tied back to this really happy memory of mom like attuning to them.
Yeah, instead of it having to be a chore that you're going to avoid later. If you're into the love languages, I think the love languages for children is really relevant in this window. So look into that. So I don't want to spend a ton of time describing it, but I think this is a good age for that introduction and to really feed into whatever your love language is for your children's love language.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay.
Teens and teens, go.
Show interest in what they are interested in and make it your mission to learn about it. So the music that they like, if they like anime, if they like TikTok, if they like Pokemon, if whatever it is, show interest in it so that you can have a conversation about it, you can participate, you can do it with them. So say your child is really, if your child's really into sports or a particular sports team, make an effort to watch games together. If they're into a certain video game, play the game with them, even if you're bad at it. Because that's really, connecting with teenagers, that is where it starts, is you have to start on their level.
On their level with their area of interest, and just know that there isn't any, like, questioning or, like, how is this or how is that? Or, like, any kind of correcting their ideas or beliefs when they're like, oh, I really want to write a book. You're like, well, yeah, I'm like, writing? You never turn in your English papers, right? Like,
yeah, don't say that.
You just...
yeah.
Find whatever they're interested in, invite them to be themselves in your space. Like, create space together where they can share those things.
Yeah, and I think the other thing that is super important is approaching this from a place of curiosity. So it's not like a question thing, but it's like they say a statement, and this is a lot of how I build rapport with teens in therapy. They'll make a statement about something when I'm just getting to know them, specifically a teen that's not super into therapy. So I have a client right now, he's super into like 90s alternative rock, which is my jam. Like, I know a lot about that. Okay. So my thing was like, we're talking about what kind of music you listen to. So he's giving me some examples, and I could tell he was guarded, and I was like, okay. And so he gave me an example of a band. I think it was REM. And I was like, yeah, I never really could like get into REM, but you know who I really got into was Smashing Pumpkins. And his like face lit up. He's like, oh, I love Smashing Pumpkins. And then I was like, oh, like, what's your favorite song? Yeah. Like, you know, and it was able to build on that from a place of curiosity. So then now when he comes in, when he talks to me about something, I ask him questions about it. So video games are like a tense subject in this house between him and his parent. And he doesn't really get the space to talk about it, because I think there's always criticism attached to how often he's on the game. So instead I was like, oh, and it's really like this connecting piece for him. So I'm like, oh, what video game do you play? And it's some game I have no idea how to play. I'm like, you know, I'm really bad at video games. So can you explain to me like how that video game works? Like, I don't like, and so then he explained it, and you see his whole demeanor change and his whole face light up. You can do that with your kids.
Yeah.
You don't have to love video games, or you can be like, can you show me how you play this?
Yeah.
Instead of saying, Or like kids who watch other people play video games, instead of saying something like, it's so lame that you watch other people play video games on YouTube. Yeah. It's like, oh, show me like what you're watching. Are you like, so do they like teach you cheat codes? Do they like, and you just be curious. Be curious.
Yeah, just be curious. Mm-hmm. And then I would say tip the scales if you're working on just reconnecting with your kiddo, tip the scales to like 80-20 for these moments, or 60-40 of like 60 to 80% we are just connecting and curiosity, and then 20 to 40% of your interactions are gonna be like the actual like redirections, demands, we got to get this stuff done.
Yeah.
But like tip the scales in the direction of connection.
And if you feel like a lot of parents feel like, okay, well, my child has so many missing assignments. This is the big thing with teens, yeah, especially neurospicy ones I get. Yeah. Or like they won't do it, like meet any demands. And so the parent feels like they need to go from 0 to 100 and meet all the demands. And it's like, okay, well, they're meeting no demands now. So yeah, let's focus on like, yes, you can absolutely tip the scales. Let's decide what demands you feel like are easiest for them to meet. Not most important to you as a parent.
Yeah.
But easiest for them to meet, and have those be your 20%.
Yes.
Because then we're building the confidence and self-efficacy and the relationship building. So then when they're meeting the demands, the praise is there from you and they're feeling confident in themselves. It's an easier demand for them to meet. And then there's going to be this momentum to where then you can add in like more
difficult. Yeah, and then you can add in more difficult, yeah, demands. Yeah. But that part, that's the direction of connection, is not conditional.
Mm-hmm. On them meeting the demands or, yes, not. Yeah.
Yes. Absolutely. It is always the same. Because honestly, truly, I believe this, and we've gotten a comment on it recently, but I treasure connection and relationship above all else. So there are a lot of societal rules and norms and things that we're expected to follow as parents, like being on time to school, mm-hmm, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, I value connection and relationship above that. Mm-hmm. And I get a lot of feedback on that, and I understand that I have privilege associated with that, that I've worked very hard to be to this point to have that privilege. But I do believe that that is where we should focus our navigator, like in parenting.
I agree. I agree.
Valuing the relationship above all of the societal rules and expectations. Yeah.
And so like to me, and I've said this before, I'll say it again, who gives a shit if your kid's missing assignments?
Honestly, I was like, don't care.
And I'm not saying that there are not lessons in doing the assignments and creating accountability and responsibility, but if you don't have the foundation, you're never going to create a model where they sustain doing that.
Yeah. And it's like, if your relationship with your child sucks and is shitty and you hate each other, what do those missing assignments even mean?
Nothing.
To me, it means nothing.
What I like to have parents do, and we're almost at an hour, so we probably need to stop soon, but is that I like to have parents visualize what they want their relationship with their child to be like when their children are grown and they have their own kids.
Oh,
so that's a good like one. So you're closing your eyes and you're visualizing like, and it's usually most parents go to like a holiday. When I do this for myself, I do it for like a holiday, and like all my grown kids want to be around me. They want to bring their spouse. They want to bring their kids. I'm like a very active grandparent, very involved. And then once I do that, I feel a lot of peace, but then I can say, am I living and building a relationship now with my child where that will be the reality?
That's so true.
And if the answer is no, and there are times with where I'm particularly struggling with like my relationship with one child, the answer may be no. And I need to look at what can I do to shift that,
yeah,
so that this can be the reality.
So this is the reality.
Because that is the goal, right? For yes, all of us. And if you're not doing that, or if you're not having that kind of relationship, then I think from a personal responsibility standpoint, you don't get to be surprised when you're a grandparent and your kids don't want anything to do with you.
Yeah. I think that's a great visualization exercise when you're trying to focus on connection, especially with the preteens and teens, because a lot of us think that we have parenting and life lessons we can teach through the teenage years, but the honest truth is the foundation happens before that.
And when I talk to teenagers, like the number one thing, the number one reason they don't talk to their parents. So like they'll tell me something like really deep and really vulnerable, and I'll hold space for it. But then if there is issues in the parent-child relationship, I'll try and circle back to like, did you talk to anyone else, any supports about this? And the answer will always be like my friends, right?
Yeah.
Friends. But it's very rarely parents. And I'll be like, what kept you from speaking to your parents about this? And it is always the fear that they're getting in trouble.
Yep.
They're just going to lecture me, or they're just going to tell me what I need to do.
Yep.
And so that shows to me, and I've done this for 10 years and a wide variety of teens. We're talking from foster care teens to teens like
in very privileged,
well-off teens. Mm-hmm. This is a continuum. And I think it is just because as parents, our goal is to teach our kids, and we tend to do it through lecturing and telling them what they need to do.
Yeah.
And on some level, every child is demand avoidant, but we also don't feel heard and seen when someone's just telling us what we're doing wrong or what we should do all the time. Yeah.
This is when that gentle honesty does most of the education throughout teenhood.
Yeah. And so just allowing that space to say like, okay, if this is the problem that most teens have with communicating honestly with their parents, what can you do to make sure that that's not a barrier? And that's checking yourself when you want to lecture, you want to say, I told you so. You want to say, well, you should do this when they come to you with a conflict about a friend.
Yeah. Yeah. You want to avoid any of the problem solving.
Yeah.
Yes. I love this. So this is actually our final chapter.
Yep.
We're done. We're done with this book, guys. We made it all the way through. And I don't know how to feel about that. Season 3.
Done. Season 4 is going to be awesome, though. Like, I'm feeling excited about season 4. And if you liked this episode, I think you're going to love season 4 because there's a lot of, like, we're still mapping all of it out. But there's a lot of, like, this very specific, like, how do you support children's big feelings?
Yes.
How do you do these?
A lot of neurodiversity affirming parenting.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of gender identity affirming parenting. A lot of self-regulation for you as a parent and how to support your child's regulations and emotional regulation.
Yeah. The main themes of we're going to do that after we actually record this episode, but a lot of the themes of our next season are self-regulation, supporting you and being neuroaffirming in your household and in your community and meeting your child's unique needs. And we have not picked a third theme yet. We're still rolling around with that one.
Yeah. But stay tuned. We're going to come back next week and just kind of do a quick wrap up and talk about our takeaways from the season. And
love ya.
Yeah.
See you next week.
Thanks for coming to Mindful as a Mother podcast. If you'd like more of us and Mindful as a Mother, you can find Paige at Instagram at Parenting with Paige and Lindsay at Linz_AdamsLCSW. Find us on TikTok, Instagram, and in our Facebook group, Creating Community and Smashing Parental Stigma, Embracing Mindful Motherhood and Positive Parenting. Thanks so much, and see you next time.